and became quite wan. It is my belief he is consumptive. I had to give him a mighty slug of brandy just to get him on.
Nathaniel nodded.
Do you think he has enough energy to last the night?
I think so. It is not a long production. Tell me, how does Miss Jones enjoy the show?
In the secrecy of the half-dark, Nathaniel's eyes flitted toward the girl sitting beside him. He made out her elegant profile, the pleasant gleam of her hair, her face contorted into a grimace of fathomless boredom. Despite himself, the expression made him grin. The grin froze and faded. After a pause, he leaned back toward Makepeace.
"Tell me, Quentin," he said, "how exactly did you know this lady was Miss Jones?"
He looked. Makepeace's small eyes gleamed in the darkness. A whisper.
"I know many things, my boy. But hush, hush now. We are coming to the climax of the performance."
Nathaniel started, frowned.
"Already? This is remarkably short. I had to bring it forward, thanks to Bobby's indisposition. He would have murdered the main soliloquy, not enough breath. But silence now. Are your lenses in? Good. Then watch."
Nathaniel's eyes returned to the stage, where he found nothing to excite him. The orchestra had struck up again. Propped against the postbox, the youth attempted a solo, his nasal whine periodically interrupted by hacking coughs. Other than him, the stage was bare. One or two of the house fronts wobbled in a breeze from somewhere in the wings. Mandrake looked in vain for some evidence of a climactic magical illusion. Nothing on second or third planes. What did Makepeace mean? A ripple of movement caught his eye on the second plane. Not from the stage, but from far off at the very back of the theatre, down behind the farthest stall. At the same instant, Makepeace nudged him with an elbow, pointed. Nathaniel looked, and looked again, his eyes wide in stupefaction. In the darkest shadows, he could just make out three exit doors leading to the lobby, and through these doors came creeping a multitude of tiny demons. Most were imps, though one or two, slightly larger, with more ostentatious crests or plumage, were possibly types of foliot. But all were small, and all were silent. Their feet and hooves, claws and stumps, tentacles and sucker-tips, passed across the theatre carpet without a sound, their eyes and teeth glittering like glass. Their clever hands held loops of rope and cloth. Their owners hopped and sprang, skittered and dodged, darted forth with eager speed toward the back row of the stalls. The leaders leapt onto the seats and without delay fell upon the person sitting there. Two or three imps to each. Rags were stuffed in mouths, hands seized and bound together with rope, heads were wrenched back, blindfolds applied. In seconds, the magicians of that row were captives. Meanwhile, the tide of imps surged on, leaping across to the row in front, and to the next. And still, through the doors, replacements came in an endless stream. So sudden was the onslaught that most of the audience was secured without a noise. A few managed the briefest squeals, only to be drowned out by the thrumming violins, the swell and sob of the clarinets and cellos. On across the stalls the demons swept, in a thin black wave, horns flashing, eyes blazing, while ahead of them the magician stared fixedly at the stage. Nathaniel wore his lenses. Through them the darkness of the auditorium was moderated. He saw it all. He made to spring to his feet. Cold steel pressed against his neck. Makepeace's urgent whisper.
"Do nothing foolish, my boy. You observe my finest hour. Is this not art of the highest order? Sit, relax, enjoy. If you move a hair's breadth, your head will bounce into the stalls."
More than half the auditorium had been engulfed, and still the imps poured on. Nathaniel's eyes rose to the boxes opposite. The senior magicians had removed their lenses, but they had vantage points similar to his own. Surely they would see, surely they would act. His jaw sagged in horror. In every box, four or five demons, much larger than the ones below, great foliots and djinn with slim white bodies of knotted sinew, had slipped through the curtains at the magicians' backs. Up they stole behind the greatest figures of the Empire. Devereux smiling and waving his hands to the music. Mortensen and Collins slouched, arms folded, heads nodding in their seats. Whitwell looking at her watch. Miss Malbindi scribbling work notes in a clip file. Up they stole, ropes rising in clawed fists, gags and nets silently adjusted, until they stood motionless, like a row of towering gravestones at their backs. Then, as if at a single inaudible command, they fell upon them. Miss Malbindi managed a shriek that merged harmonically with the wail of violins. Miss Whitwell, writhing in a bony embrace, succeeded in igniting an inferno from her fingertips. It lasted an instant. Then her mouth was closed and bound, her command cut short. The flame withered and died. She subsided in a mass of netting. Mr. Mortensen struggled manfully in the grip of three fat foliots. Above the orchestra, Mandrake heard him call out for his demon. But as with the rest of the audience, he had obediently dismissed his slave, and the call went unheeded. Beside him, Mr. Collins went down without a sound. The song was over. Mr. Devereux, the Prime Minister of Great Britain and the Empire, rose to his feet. Eyes glistening with tears, he busily applauded the finale. Behind him, in his box, three of his personal bodyguards were overwhelmed and slain. He plucked a rose from his lapel, tossed it down to the youth on stage. A demon stepped up close. Devereux was insensible. He cried out for an encore. The youth on stage stooped, picked up the rose, and with a sudden spurt of energy, flourished it at the imperial box. At that moment, the creature looming at the Prime Minister's shoulder stepped out from the shadows. The youth gave a squeal, fainted on his feet, swayed, toppled, and crashed off stage into the mouth of the euphonium. Devereux stepped back in shock and collided with the demon. He turned and whimpered once. Black wings enveloped him. To Nathaniel, all this happened in the blink of an eye. Down below, the tidal wave of imps had progressed to the front of the stalls. Every human head was bound and gagged. A triumphant demon pranced on every shoulder. His panicked eyes swiveled up to Farrah's box. In her seat, a grinning demon sat. Over its shoulder was something trussed and wriggling. He looked elsewhere, and caught a glimpse of the only magician to mount any true resistance. Mr. Sholto Pin, brooding in his box, had not removed his lenses, for the simple reason he did not wear any. He had ignored Makepeace's injunction, and kept his monocle firmly lodged in his left eye. Occasionally he removed it and polished it with his handkerchief. It was while he was so occupied that the wave of imps burst in upon the stalls. Nevertheless, he returned his monocle to his eye in time to catch them in mid-flow. He uttered an oath, caught up his walking stick, and turned to see three hulking shadows tiptoeing into his box. Without preamble, Sholto raised his stick and fired a plasm. A shadow mewled and crumpled into dust. The others darted aside, one to the ceiling, one pressed against the floor. The stick fired again. The shadow on the ceiling was caught a glancing blow. Maimed and whimpering, it fell to sprawl across a chair. But even as it did so, the shadow on the floor leapt forward. It seized the old man's stick, and using it as a cudgel, bludgeoned him to the ground. In the box opposite, Makepeace had watched this with a furrow of discontent. "It is ever thus," he mused. "No work of art can be quite perfect. It must always have a flaw. Still, Pin aside, I think we can consider this a job well done." Keeping his knife pressed against Nathaniel's throat, the playwright rose from his chair and stepped forward to better survey the scene. With agonizing caution, Nathaniel turned his head a fraction. His eyes met Kitty's. Lacking lenses, the girl had only become aware of the activity at the very end, as Pin's plasms had burst out upon the darkness, and one by one the victorious demons became visible on the ordinary plane. Eyes wide, she glanced at Nathaniel, and at last saw Makepeace and the knife. Her face showed confusion, doubt, and disbelief. Nathaniel held her gaze. His mouth worked frantically, uttering silent pleas. His eyebrows attempted complicated supplications. If the knife could just be knocked away, just for an instant, he might leap on Makepeace, tear it from his grip. Quick! If she could only act now, while the madman was distracted! Kitty looked cross at Makepeace, then back at Nathaniel once again. Her brow furrowed. Sweat ran down the side of Nathaniel's face. It was no good. She wasn't going to help him. Why should she? She held him in contempt. Makepeace was half-leaning on the balustrade, erupting into little private chuckles as he caught sight of new humiliations below. With each spasm, the knife pressed deeper into Nathaniel's neck. Then Nathaniel saw Kitty give the slightest of nods. He saw her tense, prepare to spring. He licked his lips, readying himself. Kitty Jones leapt forward. Instantly, a bolt of green energy smashed into her, knocking her back against the balustrade, which cracked and split under the impact. Emerald fire played over her body. Her limbs jerked, her hair steamed. The fire died away. Kitty slumped to the floor, her head and arm dangling out over the auditorium. Her eyes were half open, sightless. Green flames rose smoking, steaming from Mr. Makepeace's left hand, but the other kept the knife at Nathaniel's throat. His eyes had shrunk as small as raisins. His teeth were bared.
"Silly girl," he said.
He gestured with the knife. It nicked the skin on Nathaniel's chin, drew blood.
"Stand up."
Dumbly, Nathaniel stood. Around the hall, the command had been repeated 100 times. With a vast rustling, all the captives rose to their feet, blind and bound and helpless, encouraged by sundry slaps and pinches from their imps. In several cases where the experience had been too much and the victim was unconscious, one or more demons set to work to lift the body. Up in the boxes, where the djinn worked on the greater magicians, nothing was left to chance. All were swathed in thick black nets and wrapped like sausage meat. Nathaniel found his voice.
"You have brought ruin on us all."
Quentin Makepeace's face split into the broadest grin.
"Hardly that, John. We stand at the dawn of a new age. But the curtain has come down, and I must attend to the logistics. Here is someone who will ensure you retain your common sense while we are apart."
He nodded toward the back of the box. The curtain shifted. A tall figure in a black cloak stepped through. The mercenary's presence filled the space.
"I believe you know each other well," Mr. Makepeace said, sheathing his knife beneath his frock coat. "No doubt you will have much to discuss. I will not demean you, John, by uttering petty threats, but I do have one word of advice." He looked back from the top of the stairs. "Do not choose to die like poor young Kitty there. I still have much to show you."
He was gone. Nathaniel stood staring at the body on the floor. Below, in a terrible silence, broken only by the shuffling of feet and the twittering of demons, the British government was speedily removed. Part 4. Alexandria, 124 BC. Bartimaeus. It was a dangerous time in Egypt. Raiders from the south had crept up past the cataracts and put border towns to the sword. Bedouin tribes wreaked havoc on the merchant trains negotiating the desert fringes. At sea, Barbary pirates preyed on shipping. The king's advisers urged him to seek aid from abroad, but he was old, proud, and wary, and refused. In a belated effort to appease his enemies at court, Ptolemy put his talents at their service. This, as he was happy to admit, meant me.
"You must forgive this indignity," he said,
as we sat on the roof the night before I departed.
"With due respect to Affa and Penrhyn-Utit, you, my dear Reckitt, are the most vigorous of my servants. I feel sure you will carry out wonders on the nation's behalf. Follow the orders of the army captains and improvise where necessary. I apologize for any hardships you may undergo, but in the long run you shall benefit too. With luck, your efforts will get my cousin's agents off my back, and allow me to finish my researches."
I was wearing the semblance of a noble desert lion, and my growl was suitably low and deep. "You know nothing of the baseness of men's hearts. Your cousin will not rest until you are dead. Spies watch our every movement. I caught 2 priests' imps skulking in your bathhouse this morning." I had a word. "In a manner of speaking, they now serve you. The boy gave a nod.
That is gratifying to hear.
The lion gave a belch. Yes, they kindly donated their essences to strengthen mine. Don't look so shocked. In our world we are all one anyway, as I have told you. As usual, the merest mention of the other place was enough. My master's eyes sparkled with a far-off light. His face became dreamy and reflective.
"Reckitt, my friend," he said, "you have told me much, but there is more that I wish to learn. I believe that a few more weeks' work will suffice. Afa has had some experience with the shamans of a distant land. He is advising me on their methods of departing their body. When you return, well, let us wait and see."
The lion's tail struck rhythmically upon the stones of the roof. "You should concentrate on the dangers of this world.
Your cousin, Penranutet, will protect me while you are gone. Have no fear. Now, see, they are lighting the watchfire on the tower. The fleet is massing below. You must depart."
There followed a spate of much activity for me, during which time I had no contact with my master. I sailed with the Egyptian fleet against the pirates, and fought in a pitched battle off the Barbary coast, during which we successfully destroyed the principal pirate fort and released 100 captives. The scrap was memorable mainly for me fighting single combat with a fiery Afreet above 2 sinking ships. We chased back and forth along the burning oars and fenced among the rigging using portions of the broken mast. In the end I brained him with a lucky blow and watched him sink, still smouldering, into the pea-green depths. Next I marched with troops to the Theban desert and ambushed the Bedouin, carrying off a number of hostages. During our return march we were set upon by a group of jackal-headed jinn, who were only narrowly defeated. A certain red-skinned individual was prominent among them. After causing general havoc, Jabor was finally put out of action when I lured him into a system of sandstone caves and caused the tunnel roof to collapse upon him. Without pause for rest, I headed south to join the main body of the king's army in search of vengeance against the hill peoples of the Lower Nile. The campaigns here lasted 2 months, ending with the infamous Battle of the Cataracts, during which I fought 20 foliots on a lip of stone high above the frothing waters. Losses were grave, but the day was won, and peace was restored to the region. An Egyptian peace, that is. Still plenty of rape, pillage, and murder, but now carried out by us rather than against us, so that's all right. I had been put through considerable trials, but my essence was strong, and I did not resent it. In truth, my master's researches, his desire to establish parity between jinni and human, had touched me, despite my scepticism. I dared to hope that something might come of it. Even so, I feared for him. He was altogether unworldly, insensible to perils all around. One night, during our occupation of the hill country, a bubble materialized inside my tent. Ptolemy's face showed in the glassy surface, faint and far away.
"Greetings, Reckitt. I hear congratulations are in order. Word of your successes has reached the city."
I bowed. "Is your cousin chuffed?" My master seemed to sigh.
"Unfortunately, the people proclaim this as my victory. Despite my protestations, they cheer my name to the rooftops. My cousin is not pleased."
"This is unsurprising. You must... What's that on your chin? Is that a scar?"
"It is nothing. An archer fired on me in the street. Penranutet flung me aside, and all is well."
"I'm coming back."
"Not yet. I need another week to complete the work. Return in 7 days. In the meantime, go where you wish."
I stared at the face.
"Really? You're always moaning about the limitations of free will. Now's your chance to experience it. I'm sure you can tolerate the pain of this earth for a little longer. Do what you want. See you in 7 days.
The bubble became a vapor and was gone. This invitation was so unexpected that for some minutes I could only wander aimlessly around the tent, rearranging the cushions and looking at my reflection in the polished brasses. Then the full import of his words struck me. I stepped outside, took a last look around the camp, and with a cry, launched myself into the air. 7 days passed. I returned to Alexandria. My master stood in his workroom, wearing a white tunic without sandals. His face was thinner than before, his eye sockets grey with tiredness. But he greeted me with his old enthusiasm.
"Right on time," he said. "How is the world?"
"It is broad and beautiful, though there is too much water in it. In the east, mountains rise to the stars. To the south, forests swallow the land. The architecture of the earth is infinitely varied. It has given me much to think about.
Some day I shall see it too. And humans? What of them?"
"They erupt in isolated patches, like pimples on a bottom. Most do without magic, I believe." Ptolemy grinned.
"Your insights are profound. Now it is my turn."
He led me to a door and showed me into a quiet inner chamber. The floor was covered with a circle, larger than average, decorated with hieroglyphs and runes. Beside it, on the floor, were herbs, charms, piles of papyrus, and waxed tablets, all covered in my master's scrawl. He gave me a tired smile.
"What do you think?"
I was busy scanning the pentacle's barriers and word chains. "Nothing special here. Fairly standard issue."
"I know. I tried all kinds of complex reinforcements and hexes, Reckitt, but it just felt wrong. Then it occurred to me, all our normal safeguards are there to restrict movement. You know, keep the jinni out, keep us secure. I want the opposite effect. I want to be able to move freely. So if I do this..."
With a deliberate toe, he smudged the cochineal line that marked the perimeter of the circle.
"That should allow my spirit to depart. Through that little hole. My body shall remain here."
I frowned. "Why use the pentacle at all?"
"Aha. Good point. According to our friend Afa, the shamans of distant regions, who converse with jinn on the borders of our realms, speak certain words and leave their bodies at will. They do not use circles, but they are not trying to pass through the boundaries between our worlds, those elemental walls you have told me so much about. And I am. I think that just as the circle's power pulls you directly to me when I summon you, so the same circle can propel me in the opposite direction, through the walls, when the words are reversed. It is a focusing mechanism. You understand?"
I scratched my chin.
Sorry, what did Afa say again?"
My master raised his eyes to the heavens.
"It doesn't matter, but this bit does. I think I can reverse the normal summons easily enough, but if a gate does open up, I need something on the other side to guide me safely through. Something that provides a destination."
"That's a problem," I said. "There are no destinations in the other place. No mountains, no forests. I've told you that countless times."
"I know. That's where you come in."
The boy was crouching on the floor, rummaging through a pile of the usual magical paraphernalia that every Egyptian magician accumulated. Scarabs, mummified rodents, novelty pyramids, the lot. He held up a small ankh and thrust it in my direction. Ankh, a kind of amulet, T-shaped, with a loop at the top. Symbol of life. In pharaonic Egypt, when magic was commonplace, many ankhs contained trapped entities and were powerful protectors. By Ptolemy's time they were usually symbolic only, but unlike silver, always repels the jinn.
"Think this is iron?"
A waft of essence stinging cold. I leant back irritably.
"Yep. Stop waving it about." "Good. I'll keep this on my body for protection. Just in case any imps come calling while I'm gone. Now, back to you. Reckitt, I thank you for all the services you have done me. I am in your debt. In a moment, I shall dismiss you. Your obligation to me, such as it is, will be at an end."
I bowed in the customary way. "My thanks, master." He waved his hand.
"Forget that master business now. When you are in the other place, listen out for your name, your true one, I mean."
Bartimaeus, this was. Thought you might have forgotten. Ptolemy never used it, for politeness' sake.
"When I have finished my incantation, I shall call your name three times. If you wish, you may answer me. I believe that will be enough to provide the destination that I need. I shall pass through the gate to you.
I looked dubious. In that way I have. You reckon?
I do.
The boy smiled at me.
Reckitt, if you are sick of the sight of me after all this time, the solution is simple. Do not respond to my call.
It's up to me?
Of course. The other place is your domain. If you do see fit to call me over, I shall be most honored.
His face was flushed with excitement, his pupils dilated like a cat's. In his mind he was already tasting the wonders of the other side. I watched his movements as he went over to a bowl beside the window. It contained water. He washed his face and neck. "Your theories are all very well," I ventured. "But have they told you what will happen to your body if you pass across? You are not a creature of essence." He dried himself on a cloth, looking out over the rooftops, where the commotion and bustle of midday hung like an invisible pall upon the city.
"Sometimes," he murmured, "I feel I am not a creature of earth, either. All my life has been shut away in libraries, never experiencing the sensations of the world. When I come back, Reckitt, I shall wander afar like you have done."
He turned and stretched his thin brown arms.
"You are right, of course. I don't know what will happen. Perhaps I will suffer for it. But it is worth the risk, I think, to see what no other man has seen."
He stepped across and closed the shutters on the window, shrouding us both in dim, pale light. Next, he locked the chamber door. "Perhaps," I said, "you will find yourself in my power when we meet again."
"Very likely."
"Yet you trust me?" Ptolemy laughed.
"What else have I been doing all this time? When did I last bind you within a pentacle? Look at you now, you're as free as I am. You could throttle me in a blink and be gone."
"Oh. Yeah. I hadn't thought of that." The boy clapped his hands.
"Well, the time has come. Penrhenutet and Affa are already dismissed. I have no obligations left. So, it is your turn. If you want to hop into the pentacle, I'll set you free."
"What of your own security?" I glanced around the darkened room. Slats of light from the shutters ran like claw marks across wall and floor. "With us departed, you're helpless if your enemies find you."
"Penrhenutet's last task was to take my guise and ride south along the old highway. He let himself be seen. The spies will be following his caravan. So you see, dear Reckitt, I have thought of everything."
He motioned to me. I stepped into the circle. "You know, you don't need to risk yourself in this experiment," I said. I was looking at his narrow shoulders, his scrawny neck, the skinny legs sticking out beneath his tunic.
"It's not an experiment," he said. "It's a gesture. It's redress."
"For what?
3,000 years of slavery? Why take the burden of so many crimes? No other magicians have ever thought this way."
He smiled.
"That's just it. I'm the first. And if my venture goes well, and I return to record it, many others will follow after me. There will be a new era between djinn and men. I've made some of the notes already, Reckitt. My book will take pride of place in every library on the earth. I won't be there to see it, but who knows? Perhaps you will."
His passion won me over. I nodded. "Let's hope you're right." He didn't answer. Only snapped his fingers and spoke the dismissal. The last thing I saw as I departed was his face, gazing after me, confident, serene. Chapter 22 Kitty. Kitty woke to a light that blinded her and a sharp pain in her side. As the seconds passed and she lay quite still, she became aware of the blood pounding in her head and the dryness of her open mouth. Her wrists ached. There was a terrible smell of burned cloth, and a tight pressure around one hand. Panic swelled inside her chest. She wrenched at her limbs, opened her eyes, sought to lift her head. She was rewarded with scattershot pain and certain insights into her situation. Her wrists were tied. She sat against something hard. Someone was crouched beside her, looking into her face. The pressure on one hand was suddenly released. A voice.
Can you hear me? Are you all right?
Kitty opened one eye a fraction. A dark shape swam into focus. The magician Mandrake bent close. He wore a look of concern mixed with relief.
Can you speak? He said. How do you feel?
Kitty's voice was weak.
Were you holding my hand?
No.
Good.
She was acclimatizing to the light now. Both eyes opened steadily and she looked about her. She sat on the floor, at the edge of a great stone room, older and grander than anything she had experienced. Thick pillars supported a vaulted ceiling. On the floor, beautiful rugs were spread upon the flagstones. Around the walls, in many recesses, stood statues of regal men and women dressed in bygone costumes. Magical globes drifted against the vaulting, creating an ever-changing pattern of light and shadow. In the center of the room sat a brightly polished table and seven chairs. On the near side of the table, a man was walking up and down. Kitty struggled to shift her position, an operation made difficult by the cords binding her wrists. Something dug into her back. She cursed.
Oh, can you?
Mandrake held up his hands, bound tightly together, with the fingers swathed in thin white cord.
Try wriggling to the left.
You're leaning against a stone shoe at the moment. Careful, you've been badly knocked about. Kitty shifted her bottom sideways and became marginally more comfortable. She looked down at herself. One side of her coat was blackened and burned away. She could see tattered fragments of her shirt beneath, and hanging loose in an inner pocket, a singed corner of Mr. Button's book. Her brow furrowed.
How had... The theatre!
In a rush, she remembered. The explosions in the box opposite, the raising of the lights, the sea of demons in the stalls below. Yes, and Mandrake next to her, pale and frightened, with the fat little man holding the knife to his throat.
She had tried. I'm glad you're alive, the magician said.
His face was grey, but his voice was calm. There was dried blood on his neck.
That's impressive resilience you've got there. Can you see through illusions, too?
She shook her head irritably.
Where are we? What's... The Hall of Statues at Westminster. This is the room where the council meets. But what's happened? Why are we here?
Panic engulfed her. She pulled frantically at her bonds.
Calm down. We're being watched.
He jerked his head toward the figure by the table. It was someone Kitty didn't know. A young man with long, bandy legs, still pacing back and forth.
Calm down! Kitty gave a strangled cry of fury. How dare you! If I was free...
Yes, but you're not.
And nor am I, so shut up for a minute and let me tell you what's happened.
He leaned in close.
The whole government was taken captive in that theatre. Everyone. Makepeace used a host of demons to subdue them. I've got eyes, haven't I? I saw all that. All right. Fine. Well, some might have been killed, but most, I think, are alive, but gagged and tied so they can't summon anything. We all got rounded up and taken out the back of the theatre, where a group of vans was waiting. Everyone got bundled in. They threw the ministers in one on top of the other, like sacks of beef. The vans left the theatre and drove here. No one outside the theatre is any the wiser yet. I don't know where the prisoners have been taken. They must be locked in somewhere close. That's what Makepeace is seeing to now, I think.
Kitty's head ached. She struggled to grasp the implications.
Was it him who...
She looked down at her side.
Did this to me?
He did. An inferno, close range. When you tried to... His pale face flushed a little.
When you tried to help me, you ought to be dead. In fact, we thought you were dead. But just as the mercenary was taking me off... You groaned and dribbled, so he scooped you up, too. The mercenary? Don't ask.
Kitty was silent for a time.
So Makepeace is taking over?
It seems he thinks he is. The magician scowled.
The man's quite mad.
How he plans to rule the Empire without a governing class, I can't imagine. Kitty gave a snort.
Your governing class wasn't doing so well, let's face it. He might be an improvement. "Don't be a fool," Mandrake's face darkened. "You haven't the slightest idea what—"
He controlled himself with difficulty. "I'm sorry. You're not to blame. I shouldn't have brought you to the theatre in the first place."
"True."
Kitty looked around the chamber.
"But what gets me is I don't understand why either of us has been brought here."
"Nor me."
"We've been singled out for some reason."
Kitty regarded the man walking to and fro beside the council table. There was an air of nervousness about him. He frequently consulted his watch and looked over toward a set of double doors.
"He doesn't look that hot," she whispered. "Can't you whip up a demon and get us out of here?"
Mandrake groaned. "All my slaves are on a mission. If I could get to a pentacle, I could summon them here easily, but without one, and with my fingers tied like this, I'm stuck. I haven't got so much as an imp on tap."
"Useless," Kitty snapped. "Call yourself a magician?"
A scowl.
"Give me time. My demons are powerful, especially Cormac Codron. With luck, I'll get a chance to—"
The doors at the end of the hall burst open. The man by the table swiveled around. Kitty and Mandrake craned their heads. A small procession walked in. The first few persons were unknown to Kitty. A diminutive man with round, moist eyes, built like a winter twig. A dull-faced, somewhat slatternly woman. A middle-aged gentleman with pale, shiny skin and protruding lips. Behind them came a young man, slender, sprightly of step, with oiled ginger hair and glasses perched on a little nose. About these four an air of suppressed excitement seemed to hang. They tittered, grinned, and looked about them with quick, nervous movements. The bandy-legged man beside the table hurried to join them.
"At last," he said. "Where's Quentin?"
"Here, my friends!"
In through the doors strode Quentin Makepeace, emerald frock coat flapping, chest puffed out like a bantam cock's. His shoulders rolled, his arms swung with an insolent swagger. He passed his companions, clapping the ginger-haired man soundly on the back, ruffling the hair of the woman, and winking at the rest. On toward the table he went, glancing up and down the room with proprietorial ease. On noticing Kitty and Mandrake sitting by the wall, he gave a plump-fingered wave. At the council table, Makepeace selected the largest of the chairs, a golden throne, ornately carved. He sat himself, legs crossed. With a flourish, he drew from a pocket an enormous cigar. A snap of the fingers, the cigar tip burst into smouldering life. Quentin Makepeace placed it between his lips and inhaled with satisfaction. Kitty heard Mandrake beside her give a gasp of rage. She herself saw little but the ostentatious theatricality of the performance. If she hadn't been a prisoner, she might have been amused. Makepeace made an expansive gesture with a cigar.
"Clive, Rufus, would you be so kind as to bring our friends over?"
The ginger-haired man approached, followed by his thick-lipped companion. Roughly, without ceremony, Kitty and Mandrake were hauled to their feet. Kitty noticed that both conspirators were regarding Mandrake with malevolent dislike. As she watched, the older man, lips moistly parted, stepped forward and struck their prisoner hard across the face. The man rubbed his hand.
"That's for what you did to Lovelace."
Mandrake smiled thinly.
"Never been slapped by a wet fish before." "I hear you were looking for me, Mandrake," the ginger-haired man said. "Well, what are you going to do to me now?"
From the golden chair a mellifluous voice projected,
"Steady, boys, steady. John is our guest. I have affection for him. Bring them over, I say."
A grip on Kitty's shoulder. She was propelled forward to stand with Mandrake on a rug before the table. The other conspirators had seated themselves. Their eyes were hostile. The sullen-faced woman spoke.
"What are they doing here, Quentin? This is a crucial time."
"You should kill Mandrake and have done,"
the fish-faced magician said. Makepeace took a puff on his cigar. His little eyes sparkled with merriment.
"Rufus, you are far too hasty. You too, Bess. True, John is not yet part of our company, but I have high hopes that he might become so. We have long been allies, he and I."
Kitty took a sharp side glance at the young magician. One cheek was scarlet, where the blow had struck. He did not reply.
"We haven't
got time to play games."
This was the little man with wide, wet eyes. His voice was nasal, whiny.
"We need to give ourselves the power you promised."
He looked down at the table, ran his fingers over it in a gesture at once covetous and fearful. To Kitty he seemed weak and cowardly, and angrily conscious of this cowardice. From what you could see, none of the conspirators was any different, save for Makepeace, radiating self-satisfaction from his golden throne. The playwright tapped a dollop of ash from his cigar onto the Persian carpet. "No games, my dear Withers," he said, smiling. "I can assure you I am perfectly serious. Devereux's spies have long reported that, among commoners, John here is the most popular of the magicians. He could give our new council a fresh, attractive face. Well, certainly more attractive than any of you." He grinned at the displeasure he had caused. "Besides, he has talent and ambition to spare. I have a feeling he's long desired the chance to kick Devereux out and start again. Isn't that right, John?" Again Kitty looked at Mandrake. Again his pale face gave no inkling of his thoughts. "We must give John a little time," Quentin Makepeace said. "All will become clear to him, and you will shortly get all the power you can handle, Mr. Withers. If only the good Hopkins would hurry along, we can proceed." He chuckled to himself, and with that noise, with that name, Kitty knew him. It was as if a thick veil had fallen from her eyes. She was back in the resistance again, 3 years before. On the advice of the mousy clerk, Clem Hopkins, she had gone to a rendezvous in a disused theatre, and once there, a dagger held to the back of her neck, a whispered conversation with an unseen man, whose words of guidance led them to the abbey and to the dreadful guardian of the crypt.
"You!" she cried out. "You!"
All eyes turned to her. She stood stock still, staring at the man on the golden throne.
"You were the benefactor," she whispered. "You were the one who betrayed us."
Mr. Makepeace winked at her. "Ah, you recognize me at last. I wondered if you'd ever recall. Of course, I knew you as soon as I saw you with Mandrake. That's why it amused me to invite you to my little show tonight." At Kitty's side, John Mandrake stirred at last.
"What's this? You've met before?"
"Don't look so shocked, John. It was all in a good cause. Through my associate, Mr. Hopkins, whom you will meet shortly, he is currently attending to our captives, I had long followed the activities of the Resistance. It amused me to watch their efforts to see the outrage on the faces of the fools in council as they failed to track them down. Present company excepted, John."
Another chuckle. Kitty's voice was expressionless.
"You knew about the monster in Gladstone's tomb, but you and Hopkins still sent us there to get the staff. My friend died because of you."
She took a small step in his direction.
"Oh, tush!" Quentin Makepeace rolled his eyes. "You were traitorous commoners. I was a magician. Did you expect me to care? And don't come any closer, young lady. Next time I won't bother with a spell. I'll cut your throat."
He smiled. "In truth, though, I was on your side. I hoped you would destroy the demon. Then I'd have taken the staff from you for my own use. In fact," he tapped his cigar, refolded his legs, and looked around at his audience, "in fact, the outcome was mixed. You ran off with the staff, and let Honorius the Afrit escape the tomb. What an impact Honorius made!
Gladstone's bones hopping around the rooftops with a demon encased inside. A marvellous spectacle. But it set Hopkins and me thinking."
"Tell me, Quentin." Mandrake spoke again. His voice was soft. "This Mr. Hopkins was supposed to have been involved with the golem, too. Was it so?" Makepeace smiled and paused a while before answering.
"He's performing the whole time," Kitty thought. "He's an incorrigible show-off, treating this like one of his plays."
"Of course," Makepeace cried. "Under my direction. I have my fingers in many pies. I am an artist, John, a man of restless creativity.
For years the Empire has been going to rack and ruin. Devereux and the others have mismanaged it disgracefully. Did you know that several of my plays have actually had to close in Boston, Calcutta, and Baghdad, thanks to local poverty, unrest, and violence? And this endless war. Things have got to change. Well, for years I have watched on the sidelines, experimenting here and there. First I encouraged my good friend Lovelace in his attempt at a rebellion. Remember that decidedly large pentacle, John? That was my idea, he chuckled. Then came poor Duval. He wanted power, but he hadn't a creative bone in his body. All he could do was follow advice. Through Hopkins, I encouraged him to use the golem to spread unrest. And while the government was distracted, he beamed at Kitty once again, I nearly acquired the staff, which, by the way, I fully intend to take into my possession this very night. To Kitty, most of this meant nothing. She gazed at the hateful little man in the great gold chair, almost quivering with fury. She saw, as if from far off, the faces of her dead companions. With every word, Makepeace defiled their memory. She could not have spoken. By contrast, John Mandrake seemed to be becoming almost talkative.
"This is all very interesting, Quentin," he said. "The staff will certainly be useful. But how will the government be run? You have emptied all the departments. That is bound to cause problems, even with such titanic figures as these in your team."
He smiled around at the sullen conspirators. Makepeace made an easy gesture. "Some of the prisoners will be freed in due course, once they have sworn loyalty.
And the others?"
"Will be executed."
Mandrake shrugged.
"Seems a risky prospect for you, even with the staff."
"Not so." For the first time, Makepeace seemed annoyed. He rose from his chair, tossed the remains of the cigar aside. "We are about to augment our power with the first creative act in 2,000 years of magic. In fact, here is the very man who will show you. Ladies and gentlemen, I give you Mr. Clem Hopkins."
A meek and diffident figure stepped into the room. 3 years had passed since Kitty had last set eyes on him, sitting at a cafe table in the pleasant summer air. She had been little more than a girl. She'd drunk a milkshake and eaten an iced bun while he'd asked her questions about the stolen staff. Then, when she'd failed to supply the information he required, Mr. Hopkins had gently betrayed her once again, sending her to the house, where Mandrake waited to entrap her. So it had been. As the years had passed and the scholar's features had faded from her memory, his shadow had grown inside her, spread like a contagion at the back of her mind. He sometimes taunted her within her dreams. And now here he was, stepping quietly across the rugs of the Hall of Statues, a little smile on his face. His appearance seemed to awake a great excitement in the conspirators. There was a stirring of anticipation. Mr. Hopkins came to stand beside the table, directly opposite Kitty. He looked at Mandrake first, then at Kitty. His pale grey eyes surveyed her, his face expressionless.
"You traitor," Kitty growled.
Mr. Hopkins frowned a little, as if in some perplexity. He showed not the slightest hint of recognition.
"Now then, Clem," Makepeace clapped him on the back, "do not be put off by the presence of young Kitty here. It is just my little joke to remind you of your resistance days. Don't let her get close, mind, she is quite the little vixen. How are the prisoners?"
The scholar nodded eagerly. "Quite safe, sir. They cannot go anywhere."
"And what about outside? Is all quiet?"
"There is still unrest in the central parks. The police go about their business. No one knows we have left the theatre."
"Good. Then it is time to act. My friends, Hopkins here is a marvel, an absolute gem. He breathes ideas like you and I gulp air. He dreams them in his sleep, digests them with his dinner. It was he who first noticed the unique properties of the Afrit Honorius. Isn't that right, Clem?"
Hopkins gave a little smile. "If you say so, sir."
"Hopkins and I immediately observed that the demon inhabited Gladstone's bones. It was not a mere guise, an illusion of essence. The skeleton was real. The demon had mingled with the actual bones.
An ambitious idea occurred to us. Why not summon a demon into a living body? Specifically, the living body of a magician. If the magician could control the demon and use its power, what wonders he might perform. There would be no more need for pentacles, for fiddling about with runes and chalks. No more risk of fatal errors. Indeed, summoning itself would soon become unnecessary.
Kitty had learned enough from Mr. Button to realize the radical nature of this proposal. She knew enough to share Mandrake's utter disbelief.
"But the risks are far too great," he was saying. "That commoner in your workroom, he heard the demon talking in his head. It would have driven him mad."
"Only because he did not have the will to suppress the demon." Makepeace was impatient now. He spoke quickly. "With individuals of intelligence and strong personality such as us, the effect will be harmonious."
"You don't mean you're all going to take this risk?" Mandrake protested. "Surely not. The effects might be catastrophic. You don't know what might happen."
"Oh, but we do, we do. Hopkins summoned the demon into himself 2 months ago, John. He has suffered no ill effects. Isn't that right, Clem? Tell them."
"That's right, sir." The scholar seemed embarrassed to be the focus of attention. I summoned quite a powerful jinni. When it entered, I felt a certain struggling like a living worm inside my head. But I merely had to concentrate, and the demon accepted the inevitable. He is thoroughly quiet now. I hardly know he's there.
"But you are able to call on his power and knowledge, aren't you, Hopkins?" Makepeace said. "It is really quite remarkable."
"Show us,"
the female conspirator whispered.
"Yes, show us, show us."
Around the table the plea was taken up, over and over. Each face shone with furious, avid hunger. To Kitty they seemed wicked, but also helpless, like nestlings waiting to be fed. She was filled with a sudden repulsion. She longed to get away. Makepeace's eyes were glittering slits. He nudged the scholar's arm.
"What do you think, Hopkins? Show them a little, just to whet the appetite?"
"If you think it appropriate, sir." The scholar took a step back, bent his head in concentration. Then, without apparent effort, he rose into the air. Several of the conspirators gasped. Kitty glanced at Mandrake. He was watching, open-mouthed. Hopkins rose 6 feet above the floor, then drifted off, away from the table. When he was some way distant, he raised a hand, pointing it at an alabaster statue on the far side of the hall. It showed a bald, stocky magician smoking a cigar. There was a flash of blue light. The statue exploded in a shower of sparks. The ginger-haired magician whooped with excitement. The others stood and clapped, or banged the table in wild joy. Mr. Hopkins rose higher, toward the ceiling.
"Show them something else, Hopkins," Makepeace called. "Put on a show."
Everyone's eyes were craning upward. Kitty took her chance. Slowly, slowly, she backed away from the table. One step, two. No one had noticed. All were watching the scholar perform acrobatic feats high against the ceiling, trailing gouts of flame from his fingertips. Kitty turned and ran. At the end of the hall, the double doors were open. Her feet were noiseless on the thick, soft rugs. Her hands were tied, which made the running awkward, but in seconds she was through. Out into a corridor of stone, with oil paintings on the wall and glass cases with ornaments of gold. She headed right. The corridor ended at an open door. Kitty plunged through. She halted, cursed. An empty room. Perhaps an official study. A desk, a case of books, a pentacle on the floor. It was a dead end. With a gasp of frustration, she turned, ran back the way she had come, along the corridor, past the double doors, around another corner, and collided full pelt with something hard and heavy. Thrown to the side, she instinctively tried to break her fall with an outstretched hand, but her arms were bound. She could not do so. She landed heavily on the flagstones. Kitty looked up and caught her breath. A man stood over her, framed against the ceiling globes. A tall man, bearded, dressed in black. Bright blue eyes considered her. Black brows wrinkled in a frown.
"Please," Kitty gasped, "please help me."
The bearded man smiled. A gloved hand reached down. In the Hall of Statues, Mr. Hopkins had returned to Earth. The faces of the conspirators were filled with wonder. Two of the men were pulling rugs away from the center of the room. As Kitty was brought in, half-choked, hanging suspended by her collar from the bearded man's upraised grip, They stopped and dropped the rugs again. One by one, everyone turned to look at her. A deep voice spoke at Kitty's shoulder.
"What about this girl? I caught her making for the street."
The ginger-haired man shook his head.
"Blimey, didn't even notice she had gone."
Mr. Makepeace stepped forward, a petulant frown upon his face.
"Miss Jones, we really have no time for such distractions."
He scowled, shrugged, and turned away.
"At first, her presence amused me, but to be frank, she interests me no longer. You may kill her."
Chapter 23. Nathaniel. Nathaniel saw the mercenary dump Kitty on the rug. He saw him fling back his cape, reach into his belt, and draw forth a long knife, curved like a scimitar. He saw him reach out to clutch her hair, lift up her head, expose her throat.
"Wait!"
Nathaniel stepped forward. He spoke with as much authority as he could muster.
"Don't touch her. I want her alive."
The mercenary's hands paused. He looked up at Nathaniel with his steady, pale blue eyes. Then, slowly and very deliberately, he continued to pull Kitty's head back and bring the knife around. Nathaniel cursed.
"Wait, I said."
The conspirators were watching with some amusement. Rufus Lyme's pale, damp face grimaced.
"You're hardly in a position to be so lordly, Mandrake."
"On the contrary, Rufus. Quentin has invited me to join your company, and after seeing Mr. Hopkins's remarkable demonstration, I'm delighted to agree to that proposal. The results are most impressive. That means I'm one of you now."
Quentin Makepeace had been busy unbuttoning his emerald frock coat. His eyes were narrowed, calculating. He looked at Nathaniel askance.
"You have decided to fall in with our little scheme?"
Nathaniel met his gaze as calmly as he could.
"I have indeed," he said. "Your plan is an act of genius, a masterstroke. I only wish I'd paid more attention to you when you showed me that commoner the other day, but I intend to rectify that now. In the meantime, strictly speaking, the girl is still my prisoner, Quentin. I have plans for her. No one touches her, save me."
Makepeace rubbed his chin. He did not answer. The mercenary adjusted the knife a little in his hand. Kitty gazed sightlessly at the floor. Nathaniel felt his heart thudding against his chest.
"Very well," Makepeace moved suddenly. "The girl is yours. Put her down, Verroc. John, you have spoken well and have confirmed my good opinion of you. But take heed. Words are easy. Actions are better. In a moment we shall free you and watch you as you bond with a demon of your choice. But first I shall prepare for my own summoning. Burke, Withers, clear those rugs away. The pentacles must be readied."
He turned to issue further orders. Without expression, the mercenary loosened his grip on Kitty's hair. Nathaniel, conscious of hostile eyes upon him, Jenkins and Lyme in particular were watching with undisguised suspicion, did not hasten to her side. She remained where she was, slumped on her knees, head lowered, hair hanging over her face. The sight pierced him. Twice now that evening Kitty Jones had nearly died, and all because of what he'd done. Because he'd found her, because he'd wrenched her out of her quiet new life and brought her with him, just to satisfy his selfish curiosity. When in the theatre the inferno struck her, Nathaniel had thought her dead. Sorrow had overwhelmed him. He had been almost unmanned with guilt. Despite the mercenary's harsh warning, he had flung himself beside her, and only then realized that she breathed. For the next hour, while she remained unconscious, his sense of shame had slowly grown. Little by little he began to recognize his folly. Already in the last few days he had begun to detach himself from the name of Mandrake, from the role that for years had become a second skin. But only with the events in the theatre did that detachment become a true separation. The two key certainties that governed him, his belief in the invulnerability of the government and in the essential virtue of his motives, were dashed from him in a matter of moments. The magicians were overpowered. Kitty was struck down. Both came at the hand of Makepeace, and it was with horror that Nathaniel recognized, in that callous, indifferent hand, a reflection of his own. At first the enormity of Makepeace's crime almost blinded him to its nature, the theatrical panache of the coup, the bizarre perversion of the demons within the body. All the silly talk of genius and creativity helped divert attention.